Hi there, and welcome to Leadership Line of Sight. My name is Taylor Hack, and I'm really excited today to introduce you to Ashley Melke. She is the CEO and founder of the Grief and Trauma Healing Center, and honestly, I would say a specialist in loss. I'm wondering if you would agree with that, Ashley.
Yes, I would agree. And thank you so much for having me on your podcast today. I'm super excited.
I'm glad to have you here. I find it so interesting, just in reading a little bit about you, to just in that word loss. Like I constantly engage with people that are trying to improve their business performance, and what I notice is that loss at any level is something that we seem to be like very deeply programmed to experience, right?
Absolutely. The thing about grief that is so fascinating to me is it's also the one area that we are so ill-equipped to talk about and deal with. Yet loss is inevitable and it affects everyone, whether it's a personal level or it's a professional level or something related to business. So it's something that none of us can escape.
And I also feel like many people have different levels of resilience towards this. Like some people where they experience loss over something that someone else wouldn't really have ongoing challenges with. But when we're talking about loss, there's like everything that you talk about with your patients, right? You talk about loss when it comes to family relationships. But also loss when it comes to death and everything between. How do you see it? Like, are you measuring people at what happened or impact?
That's a really good question. So the thing about loss is everybody's experience is unique and individual. So you and I might experience the same loss or traumatic event, but we're going to perceive that experience differently. We're going to internalize the events differently. And a huge part of the impact is my perception of that experience, how I process the feelings, and whether or not I had someone to share that event with. So much of the impact is based on that sense of isolation and loneliness that we feel going through the loss. So, I mean, we see all sorts of losses at the Grief and Trauma Healing Center, and everyone's experience is so unique and different. So we really focus on the individual's experience and don't make any assumptions about what it's been like for them to go through that.
Now, I find it kind of interesting because I've never met an optometrist that doesn't wear glasses. Right. And normally, whenever anybody tells me they're a psychologist, I kind of immediately go to like, who hurt you? Right? Like the, because I feel that there's like a correlation there. Now, you include this publicly as part of your bio, but you experienced deep loss very young. Is that something that you see is among some of your peers in psychology? Is the same thing, is like they're attracted to this, to helping others with the experience that they had to help themselves with?
Yes, I would say it's a very common theme. I wouldn't want to speak for everyone because I think we're all motivated by different things. But certainly there is a theme that, you know, when we've gone through a loss or an experience in our own life, I think there's an attempt to want to help ourselves. And we do that by educating ourselves in the field of psychology. Most of us have therapists of our own and then wanting to be of service to others and give back, especially if we've had positive experiences.
Wow. I never really thought about therapist inception. Like what type of person would be a therapist of therapists? Now, is that something that you do?
No. So there are amazing psychologists that work primarily with other psychologists, but that just hasn't been my path. And now, like with the growth that we've had with the Grief and Trauma Healing Center, I've really stepped away from the client work just to be able to focus on the business strategy and growth.
Can you talk to me a little bit about that journey? Where did this start?
Yes. So you mentioned, you know, I talk publicly about how loss has impacted my life. And it was almost 12 years ago that my dad died by suicide after relapsing into alcohol and cocaine addiction. So, I mean, I have early memories, Taylor, of my dad being drunk and being very confused about that at, as early as 5 years old. So,
wow.
So I grew up, I would say, experiencing traumas that maybe other children haven't experienced with my dad's addiction and in and out of prison and in and out of my life. So a lot of attachment disruption as well. And so fast forward several years, when I was 23, a second year graduate student studying to be a psychologist, something I knew I wanted to be since I was 11, he died by suicide. And I realized very quickly, number one, how ill-equipped I was, even though I was a graduate student, even though I was surrounded by professionals in my clinical training and clinical placement, nobody knew how to help me. And I certainly didn't have the tools to help myself. So what started was this journey essentially of isolation and avoidance. So I kind of just buried myself in school and work and did everything I could to avoid the pain of his death. And a year later, I graduated with my master's degree and went on to become a psychologist. And it was then when this really kind of organic, beautiful thing started to happen. So grieving people started to work with me, and I became like this, the grief person, which I thought was really interesting. And I really loved it. And I came alive sitting with grieving people, but I didn't have any tools. So then I started the journey looking for what was available to help my clients. I came across a program called the Grief Recovery Method, and it was a 4-day training. It absolutely changed my life, like so much so that it was the next day that I went to the business registries and started my business, the Grief and Trauma Healing Center. That was almost 10 years ago.
That makes me excited to hear. I get excited about new entrepreneurships. Like some people get excited about babies or puppies. I'm actually kind of similar on all three. So I think that that's amazing that that was your response, was something that's like an entrepreneurial action to make something from scratch that will create value for people beyond yourself, right? Like that's how I see entrepreneurship, is the desire to exchange.
Yes. And like, so this program that I went through, there's a lot of personal work. So I was able to work through my relationship with my dad, which was so key for my healing. And I had never heard of this program in Edmonton. And so I knew I had to bring it to the community. I had to make this accessible to people. And so like most entrepreneurs, I think, unless they have business training, you don't really know what you're doing. You just kind of step into the unknown and that uncertainty, and you figure it out as you go. And, you know, as I look back at almost this decade, I can't even believe how far we've come and the growth we've had, because I had no idea.
Can you talk about the growth? Like, how would you describe where you're at now?
So we have a large clinical team of 25 plus a full administrative team. And we have two locations, like two physical locations in Edmonton. Plus we're opening a third location right now, gearing up to open our fourth location in the fall. So there's been this, I would say, steady growth, especially the last like 3-4 years. It's just amazing how, you know, when you're kind of scaling up and growing and you have to learn about new systems and you have to learn how to operationalize and you have to figure out new ways of doing things, you just do it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of where we're at today.
Oh, well, that's a sign that you're good at that. You know, like resilience is part of the toolkit. And normally, as much as like we joke about like challenge tunities or whatever the heck you want to call them, really, when you look in hindsight, they were, right? A lot of the things that in entrepreneurship that would have like do cause some people in entrepreneurship to not have a good experience, yeah. Right? Like you were saying, very few people are prepared. And I think about like a whole bunch of people on a beach with rowboats. And it's like one of you guys is going to end up being this giant ship. There's going to be a whole bunch of you that come back to the beach, no rowboat, right?
So good. Yes, absolutely.
I think that's how it feels sometimes too.
Totally.
So when you see your team now, can you take me through what would be like the milestones? So a lot of people would look at where you are right now, maybe from them having their like incorporation registration in their hand. And say like, oh, you've made it. It's like done now. You just ride on this.
Right. Well, it's sorry, go ahead.
What like, well, I guess I want to hear your response to that.
It certainly doesn't feel like that. Like, okay, now we've made it and we just get to, you know, it's easy peasy now. There's challenges at every level. Anyone who's been in business knows that. There's the challenges of first getting started and kind of getting those ducks in a row of how do I even launch and start a business and how do I market myself? How do I get comfortable putting myself out there? And then I would say comes the next stage around, okay, you know, I'm ready for, you know, I can no longer sustain the work that's coming in. I'm talking about private practice. And so I have to hire someone. Well, what does that look like? What's the model of hiring? How do I pay someone? And then, you know, then it becomes easier the next time you hire. And then you're looking at office space and you're looking at brand awareness and, you know, bigger marketing campaigns and systems in place to be able to have a large team. So I feel like, you know, from day one to today, there's been ongoing challenges and really hard seasons. Like I've had to learn some really painful lessons, Taylor, about understanding my business, understanding the finances, knowing how things are run on the back end and not just trusting other people to do that because I've ran into trouble in that situation. And I just always know when we hit a storm in business, I know it's going to be transformative. I know it's supposed to elevate my growth as a business owner and, you know, deepen that capacity for resilience. And then it's like, sure enough, we launch that next level every single time. So I'm honestly no longer afraid of that discomfort and challenge of entrepreneurship.
You were talking about a place that you were growing through failure. And it was around financial awareness.
Yes.
When I ask entrepreneurs about this, the way that I tend to ask the question is, if your relationship with your finances was your Facebook relationship status, how would it look? Are you married to them? Are you dating? Are you single? Is it complicated?
Yes, it's so good.
Can you talk to me about like what you learned?
Oh my gosh. I would say status complicated for sure. And just fully avoidant. Like, let's not even talk about the relationship. That's where I was at. And it wasn't that money was an issue. It's just, I didn't understand or I didn't want to learn about my expenses and profit and loss and profit margins and all these things that I really knew nothing about, especially not having a business or finance background. Like, I started a business because I'm passionate as a psychologist. I'm passionate about serving the community and helping people, not how to run numbers and understand numbers. So when we went through this little crisis, this was about 3 years ago, I knew I didn't have a choice. It was forced upon me, Taylor. It was going to be me or who, right? I'm the business owner. And if this ship is going to keep going, there's a lot of circumstances I'm not going to talk about, but essentially I was now in charge of looking at these things. And so I had to sit down with my accountant. I had to get an official bookkeeper. I had to look at all of these things, print out my statements and learn. And although it was a really painful period to go through, it was so key. And I'm so grateful that I went through that because now I understand the finances. I'm in there every other day. I know the numbers. I know my statements. And I feel super confident about where we're at financially, where we're going. And I can project sort of those plans for growth as well.
So projection is like, normally when you work through this, if it was martial arts, there'd be like levels. And once you get into people that can accurately project, that's like a deep black belt level. Right there, it's so tricky, and there's so many variations, and a lot of people don't understand that most of the people that actually have a strong relationship with their profit and loss statements, they're normally very ranked up. They're not white belts. Like, I can see how that would blindside you, because isn't the mentality, I'm here to do the help, and if I'm a good helper, the money will just be there?
Yeah, I think I'd say it's like more the first part for me is like, I'm here to serve. We know that the money's coming in, or we hope that payment is coming in. I assume the person who's in charge of that is collecting payment and doing accounts receivable and following up. And I think it was just, I kind of just put my blinders on to what was happening, like on the administrative billing side of things, and just trusting instead of really knowing and looking in and checking in. So that was really key for me. And now that I see it, it's like, I have all of this knowledge, like you said, and we can look at what does it look like if we open another location? Can we financially, do we have the cash flow to be able to pay for that? Or what does that look like? And in terms of new intakes, how is this going to impact our gross revenue? And, you know, all of that, which feels really good. I mean, I still don't know everything. I'm definitely not an expert, but at least at this point, I know enough.
Yeah, it will help you gauge your ability to help, right? Yes. Because that's what that second location is to you.
Yes, exactly. So it's making those resources more accessible, and, you know, increasing our clinical capacity so we can serve even more clients. And then that's also why we're moving into different cities and provinces, so that, you know, we can kind of duplicate what we've done here, knowing there isn't a lot out there. There's no one out there who specializes in grief and trauma the way we do. And we know that the need is there. And our vision is really kind of the, you know, that North Star for us, which is everyone will have the tools to heal from loss and no one will grieve alone. That's our vision. So as long as we are taking steps towards that vision, helping grievers across Canada, like, that just makes my heart just, you know, explode with joy. And so I think knowing all the businessy things obviously is very important to be able to fulfill that vision.
So if this is like a missing resource out there, what's the effect? So those people that don't have a way to process grief, how does that manifest in their lives when they don't deal with that?
Oh my gosh. It manifests in so many different ways. So what happens is when we there's a whole narrative here, right? When it comes to grief in our culture, which is you have to be strong, grieve alone, don't feel bad, suck it up, get over it, you know, just give it time. And so there's this idea that we just need to isolate and avoid, keep busy and give it time and everything will be okay. But what actually happens is all the energy of those unresolved feelings, those unresolved emotions, and a lot of time trauma becomes trapped in our body. And so then it starts to manifest in ways like physical illness and ailments. That could be things like chronic pain or headaches. That could be even leading to something like a cancer diagnosis. And there's research that backs this up. It also leads to issues with substances and behaviors. So, you know, addiction is highly prevalent. So we turn to alcohol, drugs, workaholism, you know, our social media, shopping, any way to kind of escape and give us temporary relief from our pain. And it's going to impact us in our relationships. So if I've got all of these unresolved wounds, how am I going to be able to show up fully and wholeheartedly and presently for others as a parent, as a spouse, as a, you know, friend, as a boss? So that's, it has the sort of cumulative impact on people's lives when we avoid it. And it stays with us. Like, even if it's been 50 years, like Taylor, I have worked with people that have been grieving a loss for over 50 years, if you can imagine, and the pain is still there and so real and so present for them.
How does it ever go away?
This is where taking actions and working through evidence-based approaches of healing is really key. So going to therapy, working through the grief recovery method is one of our specialty areas, doing things like EMDR therapy, which is a trauma protocol, doing
that's eye movement, right?
Yes. So it's bilateral stimulation, which is like incredible. EMDR is truly the magic bullet in therapy.
Oh, I listen to things that like music and things like that, that's bilateral and designed for that. So I know how it can be like super soothing.
Yes. So like therapy is so important. Like, and it's great that it's become, there's less stigma now around people reaching out for support. Like we have to take care of our mental and emotional health. Like we do our physical health, right? We go to the gym. No one judges us for working out, going for a run, playing hockey, whatever. But what about our emotional mental health? It's like going to the gym, right? For our brain and for our heart.
Did you know that they used to? So like, they used to make fun of people for going for runs.
Really?
Yeah. Like Phil Knight is the founder of Nike. Yes. And he wrote a great book called Shoe Dogs.
Yes, I have it, but I haven't read it yet.
Oh, so good. But he talks about how like there wasn't even shoes for it. Like if you saw somebody running down the street, you'd assume they're running from something. They didn't understand it. Like so many people worked so much that that was exercise. So to see somebody do exercise as part of recreation was like mind blowing. Wow. But we're seeing therapy go through the same thing. Whereas if you were in therapy, like when I was a kid, you were damaged, yes. Right?
Yeah.
And other people normally sent you there.
Yes, absolutely. And now it's a conversation that people are willing to have. And we're not so ashamed about that. I have a couples therapist, an individual therapist, and a spiritual director. And they're like three people on my team. If I say I have a team of people around me that help support me and take care of me, those three people are very key in my world. And I meet with those people monthly as a part of my own just emotional mental health journey, because it is different than talking to a friend. It's different than talking to your partner. It's, you know, someone who is there with a job to help you get where you want to go and to keep you accountable.
Also, like our interactions with even our spouses and other people in our life can be so fleeting now. Like if you're a busy parent with kids, your opportunity for those social contact that would even lead a friend to being like, man, you've been glum for a long time. Like they see you so infrequently that you have less people even checking out for you now.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very true. We lose sight very easily, especially in this culture. And particularly I would say in Alberta culture where we're very like, you know, a working province and we
get her done.
Yes. We like celebrate workaholism and being burnt out, that we do lose sight of those values that truly are the most important. And that has been a huge gift for me as a grief psychologist is, wow, nothing is guaranteed. I see it every day. People dying, you know, unexpectedly and tragically, other loss experiences, diagnoses, people just getting a terminal illness and dying within a week. That, you know, the one gift for me is that relationships are number one, and we have to tell the people that we love and care about how much we love them and value them every day and not delay, because we don't know. We don't know when it's our time or someone else's time. And like suicide is huge right now. Like it's already this kind of silent pandemic in our world, but especially this last couple of years since COVID hit, I've been seeing this so much, Taylor, the isolation and loneliness that people have felt. And they don't have those tools to reach out for help. And so they're deciding to die as a way to end their pain. It's excruciating.
So this is something that's like, I think it's like a self-blind spot, right? I know that when they interview people that have attempted suicide and it didn't work out, that almost all of them regret the attempt. Now, when someone is going into that, I hear a lot about things like looping and things like that, where they just keep recurring towards this thought. It's almost like a target fixation. How do you know if you're at risk?
If you're having imminent thoughts of death, if you're having thoughts of, I want to die, I'm thinking of killing myself, you're starting to make plans in your head about what, how you might do that, you have means accessible. I mean, these are risk factors. If you have had suicidal thoughts or ideation in the past, there's a lot of other factors too. Like, are there previous losses or traumas that you haven't dealt with recently or long ago that might be impacting you? Are you going through a really hard time right now and it feels hopeless and you don't have supports in place? Maybe you don't have a safe person to reach out to for help. I would say those are all risk factors. Addiction also would be a risk factor.
So if we were to give this as like the Alberta checklist, right? And who are we reaching out to? Like, who are the most at risk people?
Well, it's not quite that black and white. Again, I would say if it's someone, I'm speaking very generally, someone who has had recent or historical trauma that is unresolved or not dealt with, someone who struggles with addiction, someone who's lost someone to suicide, because that's very common too.
That makes you more likely?
It does increase your risk.
Really?
At least in the immediate term, yes. In fact, it increases everyone's risk. So if we... say a friend of ours died by suicide this week, our risk actually increases 3 to 5% to start to think about our own death by suicide, just by that happening. So yeah, lack of resources and supports, feeling hopeless and helpless, feeling like, you know, there's no end in sight, feeling like there's no tools that are going to help me take this pain away. That would be a risk factor.
So this is something that I have also seen with people that seem that they don't feel well. Like, normally where I run into it is I exchange with a bunch of entrepreneurs. Right. And I went through this in my own life when I stopped goal setting. So I achieved all the goals that I was after. And then I just had this awful experience for like 6 months to almost a year, to the point where I'm like, okay, you know what? It's time to start taking action on this. I'm going to go talk to people about it and so on. But being a normal guy, probably way past when I should have. Okay. And the truth of the matter was, is when I stopped looking forward, I didn't realize it. And then I started looking backward and more looking at the world from a scarcity aspect of like, oh, somebody's going to take away what I've achieved, as opposed to looking forward at things that I want to pursue. Is that something that's like, is correlative, less like a reach into the future?
Well, it really depends. And firstly, thank you for sharing that and being open about that. I think it's great that you're willing to share, because it's so validating for other people and normalizing that, like, even if you have it together and you're successful, you know, it's still normal to go through seasons of pain and suffering. I know I certainly have had a number of those personally and professionally. And so it's permission giving for others to say, okay, I'm not alone and I can talk about this. There's not maybe necessarily a correlation with suicide risk. That would be really individual based. There would have to be a lot more information for us to look at to see if what that risk would be. But I would say, in terms of like just struggling with depression or, you know, a loss of meaning or purpose, loss of hope, I think that would be a really much more common experience for people.
Mm-hmm. I one of my favorite books is Man's Search for Meaning.
Yes.
You like that one as well? Yes. And I really found that to be interesting to see that correlation of like meaning, you know, the finding purpose. It also gives me perspective when I meet people that have achieved so much, because they have to like continually find purpose, and it's harder to find once you get to a certain altitude.
Yeah. Well, and my belief is, and I'm a Christian, and so my perspective is, you know, every single person is born with a God-given purpose, and everyone's purpose is different and unique. And our journey is to discover what that thing is. What am I being called to do in this world? that's going to make an impact. And it's not how much money am I supposed to make in this life or how many awards am I supposed to achieve. I think that's all the byproduct of really focusing on being of service to others. And everybody has that purpose, and it's only going to mean something when it is in the service of other people, when I'm impacting lives, when I'm giving back. And we can do that in any vocation, any career. We can discover that meaning, and how it shows up, I think, like what you're saying, is going to shift as our career maybe changes or evolves, but the purpose stays the same. I think so.
Mm-hmm. When you're taking a look at developing your business the way that you do, the people that you care for as, like, I'm not sure if they're employees or contractors.
Both.
But that group of 25, that's got to be some pretty interesting management challenges.
So I think we're a team of 28 or 29 with our administrative team. But what I've put together is a really beautiful leadership team. So we have directors that really focus on different parts of the business that I can no longer sustain and manage myself. So we have our director of people and culture. We have two clinical directors, which is so key in the work that we do. We have a director of community engagement, and we have our COO, who does like the day-to-day operations for the business. And then we have the administrative team. So putting this team together for me has been so key in maintaining our culture, which is like number one for us, the relationships and connection and family-oriented feel that we have as a team, and also making sure that as we grow ethically, we're still operating at the highest level of clinical care and excellence. And I know I could not do this without them, 100%.
Wow. So that's great that you have it organized like that. Now, you were scaling up to this, right? What do you feel as though is different about caring for psychologists as their employer as opposed to maybe some other industries?
You know what? I'm not sure what would be different if they were another industry. I think what is wonderful about leading a team of therapists is they are so self-aware. They are already prioritizing their mental and emotional health. They have so many skills and tools that, like, there's so much that we can leverage as a team because of just who we are and what our training is. And they see the value in working for an organization that prioritizes culture and leadership. You know, they value things like balance and autonomy in their schedules. You know, they have very strong boundaries. They know what, like, we're very clear on expectations as a team. So it's really wonderful. And it kind of makes my job a lot easier, to be honest, just because of who they are and what they value. And then as a part of our hiring process, we have a very rigorous hiring process. And a big part of our preliminary hiring is making sure that they are not only a clinical fit, but a culture fit, and that they really buy into our mission, vision, and values, and they believe in the work that we do. Also, they have had an experience of loss in their life that really rocked their world, because it is so important to me that when they're sitting with our clients, not only clinically can they sit with them, but they really get it on a personal level, what it's like to go through a painful loss. And I think that is our competitive edge. That's what makes us stand out in the field.
Now, you were talking about people dealing with loss and having a method, and this was a method that's a big part of your company. Can you unpack that a little bit?
Yeah. Excuse me. So it's called the Grief Recovery Method. It's an action-oriented program. It's delivered in different formats. We have a two-day intensive. We have a seven-session individual. We have an eight-week group program. So we can offer in all sorts of formats. But essentially, it's this program that walks us through these steps with the goal of emotional completion. So what that means is when someone comes in and someone died or they're going through a divorce, or there's been a loss of trust or any other loss experience, we want to help them understand what is emotionally unfinished in this relationship. What are the things you wish had been better, different, more? What are the loss of hopes, dreams, and expectations in that relationship that are keeping you stuck? And then we take all these steps, including, you know, defining what grief is, debunking the myths and misinformation about grief. We look at your coping mechanisms through grief. We do a whole loss history graph of all the losses that have impacted your life. And then we come to that recovery part of the program where we really focus on completing that relationship that brought you in. I'm not going to tell you all the steps, because I want to like save a little bit. If people are curious, they'll have to buy the Grief Recovery Handbook or reach out to us. But we essentially take these actions to emotionally complete that relationship. And that person doesn't have to be alive. And if they are alive, they don't have to be in your life. It's totally a process that we go through individually to find peace in that relationship and then be able to move forward in a healthy way. Still feeling feelings, still often grieving, but not stuck with all that unfinished business.
Mm-hmm.
So it's
feeling that way. So the first time that I ever went to therapy, I called 17 different therapists just to hear them talk on the phone.
Wow.
And the way I describe my situation is that it felt like there were boxes in the trunk of my car. And for some reason, I couldn't touch them and I couldn't get them out. But every time I went to check, there was like more boxes. And then I was getting to the point where I was concerned as to whether or not my car would run anymore. And what you're telling me here is that the reason was there were some things that were unfinished there and I couldn't process it. So if I couldn't process it, then I couldn't complete the delivery effectively and remove these boxes.
Yes. Yes.
It's totally cumulative, right?
Absolutely.
The one situation that I probably needed the most management with, all the other boxes were not like that, but they were because of that. Right? And that accumulation and that compounding effect is what we wear and what we carry.
100%. 100%. I love that analogy of the car with the boxes in the back. The one that I use is like a suitcase with rocks.
I see.
And,
yeah.
Right. And you've got like little pebbles, you've got boulders in there, and eventually you're lugging along four different oversized suitcases everywhere you go. And we wonder, why am I unhappy? Why am I struggling? Why can't I get out of bed in the morning? Why am I so afraid to allow others to see me or to trust again or to get close to people or to reach for my dreams? Well, it's often this accumulation of unresolved loss and trauma and all this stuff, this baggage, right? That keeps us back, holds us back.
I like how you were saying the way you're describing carrying the rocks really shows how it limits your capacity.
Yes.
So part of the reason that it's like run down day over day and so on is you're losing capacity and then you're experiencing discomfort from the fact that you don't have that energy. You don't have that like interest. You don't have anything left to have interest, like to develop it, right?
Exactly. Your window of tolerance shrinks. So if this is my capacity to deal with life stressors, to deal with my emotions, to go through just the day-to-day life is so limited.
Yeah.
And when we start to unpack those boxes or the suitcases, you know, one rock at a time or one box at a time, then we can start to have some healing and create capacity. And, you know, that is my hope for everyone. Like, especially with the work that we do, is people are willing to look at what is in those suitcases or open up the trunk, see what's in those boxes, and take those steps one by one to heal those wounds so that you can show up and be the person that you are and you want to become and just feel free, right? Have a life of meaning and purpose and joy and love and presence and not be limited by those things in the past.
So that's the difference you experience and see?
Yes. Yes. And I have personally experienced that going through these methods that we specialize in. And that's actually how we came to develop our approach, is what's worked for us, right? Grief recovery, EMDR, somatic therapy, body-based therapy. We think it's a powerful marriage of these three approaches that really helps people to get where they want to go, and often very quickly.
That's interesting. So why did you, like, you were saying that it was because it was based on what would work for you, right? Now, can you talk a little bit about what those are and how they're relative to each other?
So yes, and that's sort of how we started, is what has worked for us, what's evidence-based, and let's start there. So the grief recovery method was the very first kind of signature program, based on me going through that method and being like, I think every human being on the planet needs to go through this. So that's our number one, working with grief. The second was EMDR, eye movement, desensitization, and reprocessing, which just helps individuals to process and integrate traumatic memories, and to be able to put those to rest and not have those things pop up and disrupt their lives any longer. So EMDR is awesome. And then the third prong is our body-based approaches. So helping people heal trauma through the body. So a few of the approaches are called somatic experiencing and sensory motor psychotherapy and Hakomi therapy. So I do not specialize in those approaches. We have experts on the team who do, but they really focus on slowing things down, helping people to tap into the feelings, the sensations coming up in their body, and to be able to name those and process those through therapy.
So just to be clear there, you were talking about the cycle of motor skills, not actual motorcycles.
Correct.
Because motorcycle therapy, I think that you would get a lot of traffic. Like, being a marketer, I'm going to tell you, if you offer motorcycle therapy, I think that's what a lot of motorcyclists think that it is.
Right. Probably, yes. They're not the same.
Not the same.
But I would recommend it. Why not? Go for a drive.
When you're talking about the eye movement as well as the motor cycle therapy,
the sensory motor, yep.
This is like the relationship of your body and some of your some of the things that you're not deciding, right?
Correct. Yes.
Involuntary is the word I'm looking for. Like, yeah. I was like today years old when I found out that your eyes are not close to your brain. They are your brain.
Oh,
right. Like I spend some time in tech, and there's this amazing company out of the States that is they're basically sending lasers to broadcast off your retina and can create augmented reality for surgeons so that they can, which is augmented reality in surgery is also something ARISMD does. We've had Scott and Chandra on here as well. And you know, Chandra. So that's the space that we're involved in. And so seeing when we say, like, how do we get the most information into someone's brain, that ocular nerve is like your cable system, right?
Super cool. Fascinating.
Yeah. So with this, like, your eyes are so connected to your brain that they're pretty much the same thing. So when you're saying that eye movement, you're teaching people to cycle their eye movement in a positive way, because they probably don't realize that they're cycling their eye movement in a way that triggers a whole bunch of animal stuff.
Well, so the thing is, it can be, eye movement is only one way. So EMDR can, it's any bilateral stimulation. So some people will follow the hand back and forth. Some people follow a light bar. I use buzzies with my clients, and I prefer it for myself. So you hold them in your hands and they buzz back and forth, like, right? So it's still bilateral stimulation without the eye movement. So what's happening in the brain, and this is the interesting thing about EMDR, is they don't know why it works. They just know it does. When the bilateral stimulation is happening, it's a distraction in the cerebral cortex. It's giving the brain a task to focus on while the emotional center of the brain, the limbic system, is processing the emotional impact of the trauma. Because with trauma, oftentimes our higher brain gets in the way of our healing. We've got belief systems, we've got thoughts, we've got all of these things that get in the way of us actually just absorbing and digesting the trauma. So by distracting you with bilateral stimulation, your brain can actually heal that event like that.
Okay, that sounds amazing. Very different than my understanding of what I was just speculating, but like that's interesting to have you break it down like that. So what you're saying is that you basically are taking part of the brain and saying, "Hey, do this." Well, yeah. We give the other part of your brain room to fix itself.
Yes. And our brain is always, always on the path of healing, but we end up getting in our own way. So that's why I had a client who her partner attempted to murder her. Like, it was horrific, this event, like going to stab her to death. She was going to die. Her belief in that moment is, I am going to die. This is it. And the trauma, the PTSD that developed from that was horrific. So when she came to me, we did one session of EMDR, Taylor, and it was cleared.
Wow.
So what? She was a 10 out of 10 in terms of her, we call it a subjective unit of distress. So she was a 10 out of 10 on her side, where it's like, she feels it rushing through her body. She feels tight. She feels scared, fight or flight. I'm going to die.
What you're describing is after the event, she would relive it, right?
Yes. Yes.
And you're saying that it would affect her heart rate. She would basically be in a physical state like she was in the event, but this could be cued by something that was like her talking through it, or something that was totally involuntary, something that like looked like that or sounded like that could trigger her into that experience.
Exactly. It could be anything that's a reminder.
Mm.
Or it could just happen. So, and she had nightmares and flashbacks, and all those things are very normal when it comes to going through a traumatic event. So when we did the EMDR, we were able to take her 10 out of 10 to zero in one session.
Wow.
And I said, like, now when you think about the event, like, what do you notice? Nothing. I noticed nothing. And it's almost like it happened to someone else. Like, I'm watching it on a TV screen.
That's incredible.
Yes.
I can't remember. Go ahead.
She will never forget the event.
Mm-hmm.
But it's processed in her filing cabinet in her hippocampus, where we store all of our memories. It's filed away like as if it was a memory. She just went to the grocery store to buy groceries earlier today.
So that's like the thing that I wonder what your perception of is. I heard this story about this woman who is standing in her kitchen, and she's in an abusive relationship, and the husband yells from the other room, "Hey, get me a beer," in a gruff voice, and a car passes outside, and she's got the water running, getting ready to do dishes. And then she goes and gets him a beer. But as she does that, something comes on the radio and it distracts her. She's, from his opinion, slower. He loses his beans. He hits her and knocks her out. Now, the way that the brain can process this is, at one level, the water running and the car are like not taken into consideration at all, because like you were just part of an assault, right? Like, that is like the most important thing that happened that day, that week, that month, that year kind of thing, right? But on another level, the way our brain records it as a memory is that the water running, the car, the radio transmission, and the event itself, the assault, are all just equal on a recording. And then if enough combinations of the other things, like the water running in the car happening, your body will have a response as though the trauma is also happening. Is that wrong?
No, that's correct. Absolutely. Absolutely. Because when you experience a trauma, all of your senses absorb that memory, and that memory becomes trapped in your body with all of those sensory experiences. Exactly what you said. The sights, sounds, smells, the event itself, all of that becomes trapped.
And so because of the missing priority, like if everything's important, then nothing is important. Like, how could you ever approach that? And you found a way to allow to basically like take the lid off for a second and sort out that reel that's all messed up.
Exactly. And it kind of, any part of that experience that is sort of stuck in your, you know, in that pathway in your brain is going to be healed when you do things like EMDR, because your brain just knows what it needs to do to heal. That's the power of our brain. If you give it space to do that. So the cool thing about EMDR is when we're processing a trauma for you, part of you is with me. Like you're totally present in the room with me and you're safe and your body knows you're safe. And it's the only way that you can process trauma effectively is when you are safe. So by me being there and even reminding you, like, part of you is here with me, right? You are safe. You're doing good work. Your brain is like, okay, great. I'm in this room with Ashley. I'm safe. And I'm giving myself the space and my body the space to feel the pain of that event and heal it and have this bilateral stimulation distraction at the same time, which is super cool.
I think this is so amazing. I want more people to understand if you're experiencing this symptom, it might help. So I'm going to give you another scenario that, and you tell me if this is something that that some people experience.
Sure.
So, you know how like you'll find yourself thinking about something negative over again, and it will be something that you're like intentionally trying not to think about. You know it causes you pain, and it will like mess up your day. Like if you had a meeting or you were going to meet a friend with a coffee, if you're driving in your car and all of a sudden you start thinking about that relationship, maybe with a parent that has like just, you just wish that you got the parent that maybe they advertised for.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. Like the parent on the poster and you don't have that relationship and something comes on the radio that maybe it's your mom and it's a song you remember from your childhood. And now you're ruined. Now, like you're going to rehearse conflict in your mind until you get to that coffee or that interview that you're going to. Is that the stuff you're talking about at like a lower level?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So many of our core beliefs about ourselves or about the world come from trauma and loss in our life. And a lot of those core beliefs are formed very, very young in those formative years, usually before 7 years old. So when we start to do this work, like you might come in, Taylor, and say, you know, I was in a recent car accident and I'm having nightmares and flashbacks. I want to heal this event. We can certainly do that. But what we discover when we kind of do this history of your trauma and kind of prepare you for EMDR is we actually discover that, you know, the accident is the most recent, but we've also have the worst, the first, right? And we can go way back to say,
this is one of the boxes in your trunk.
Yes. Mm. We discover, wow, since 5 years old, that was the first time you remember feeling like that. That's the first time you had a belief that, you know, I'm not good enough or, you know, I'm a failure. And we can clear all of that, all of those neural networks that are impacting you, or we can just choose the most recent. Like, that's the cool thing is you can kind of do as much or as little as you want. No pressure. You don't have to clear every trauma of your life. You can just decide which ones you want to kind of pick and choose too. But yes, that would be that belief, the things that keep coming up would be an indication that there's some work to do for sure.
That's amazing. So as part of your own story, you now feel as though some of the things that were very traumatic are filed appropriate.
Absolutely.
I don't know that most people would even know what that feels like.
So what it feels like is I can talk about it, I can think about it, I can share without it turning painful and trigger me to run away and have a panic attack or to isolate or to avoid it. That's what it feels like for me now.
So to some people, that's going to sound crazy. So what you're saying is that you are now comfortable.
Yes.
With the idea, the association, the stigma, and the understanding related to your father dying by suicide and you having to like go through the experience of not having a dad the way other people had a dad.
Absolutely. Now, what I do still feel is sadness. I miss my dad. There's moments and days where you know, I cry for him because he's not here. I still have a normal human response to him not being here, but it's not a trauma response. It's so triggering and painful. I have to isolate or run away from it or bury myself under a distracting behavior. I can actually recognize it, feel it, talk about it. I have a great support system and just kind of like let myself process that and then move forward. That's the difference, right? That's the gift in working through things like grief recovery or EMDR is, and even just talk therapy, right? Talking about it has been so helpful for me.
Well, that's incredible. I think that there's so many people, definitely like when we take a look at the last few years, that are dealing with things that they haven't processed because they've been under like a general threat response. Yes. You know, they'll deal with this later. They'll deal with this later.
Absolutely.
Well, I think that, you know, with some things you get to choose, right? Like eventually, like when you decide to go back to the gym or whatever else like that, you'll choose. But a lot of the time, mental health chooses you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes. Like we can try to escape it and avoid it, but it's there. It's going to be there, and it's going to continue to impact us until we decide to do something about it. And that's why, you know, personal ownership is so key to that journey forward. It's like, I have to own it. I may not be responsible for the circumstances, but I am responsible for what I do with the feelings I have today.
Yeah, because like we know that hurt people hurt people, right? Like the relationships is where the strain is.
Yes.
And that person themselves is like, well, I had it worse, right? I'm softening it for the people around me. And they don't understand that sometimes the only experience the other people have of them is that, right?
Yeah.
Like imagine if someone around you that you cared about, their only experience of you was of you being sharp or not having capacity to care for them because your capacity is being used by something that happened almost 50 years ago.
Exactly. It's exactly it. And sadly, so many people live that way, Taylor. And so many people that is how they live their life forever. And it breaks my heart. Because it doesn't have to be that way. It doesn't. Where we can choose different.
Well, I have to say that, you know, it's always hard to hear that someone who's been through very difficult things. But I genuinely believe that our greatest weapons to help everyone match our wounds.
Yeah.
Right? Like your greatest weapons for tomorrow match your wounds from yesterday. I find some people that had massive disconnects in their life become these amazing connectors. I see these people that have had like challenges of coming from nothing that now yield resources in incredible ways. And so I think that this is something that is truly a gift for you, right? Like the, especially if you can do it at scale. So congratulations on the success you've experienced, because I'm sure that it's, direct correlation to the amount of your energy and love that you put into this.
Thank you. That really means a lot. And honestly, it feels like what I've learned from my dad's death, the relationship that we had, where we are today, it really feels like such a beautiful legacy for him as well. And that's what really motivates me and inspires me, is this isn't just about, you know, the Grief and Trauma Healing Center making an impact. It's really about, you know, the legacy. And I'm really proud of that. And I'm really grateful today to have gone through what I went through with my dad, because I wouldn't be here. I don't know who I would be or what I'd be doing. And I'm just really grateful that God put me on this path, knowing that he would then use me in the service of others through this, you know, horrific loss. So thank you, Taylor, for this opportunity to talk about this on your show and let people know about the work that's available out there. So that people can take that step for themselves as well.
I think it's super important. And I really appreciate you joining us here. I've been here with Ashley Melke, and she is the founder and CEO of the Grief and Trauma Healing Center. As I said before, a loss specialist. So thank you so much for sharing your story. This is Leadership Line of Sight. And my name is Taylor. I really appreciate you listening. Thank you for joining us today. And I hope that you can use this information to help someone near you.